Hello, welcome to The Rest is History, our latest bonus episode. Tom, you had a good week?
I have had a good week. I have nothing particularly to report.
So, Tom, I've been doing some preliminary work on the next Adventures in Time, which is, as you know, Horatio Nelson, Hero of the Seas, or something like that.
I'm so proud of that. And I'm taking credit for that.
Are you?
Because you were going to be doing Napoleon, weren't you?
Well, actually, do you know the
and
thing?
And I called you out.
It's actually not just because you call me out. Or it's actually not at all because you call me out.
Oh, isn't it?
I'll tell you what it is. It's because it's impossible. It's because 20 chapters of 3,000 words each on Napoleon. His career is so vast, so stupendous.
Yeah, well, I saw that as well, obviously. But I always thought that you would be happier doing Nelson.
I'd actually always slightly undervalued Napoleon, I think out of sort of John Bullishness. And then when I started, because my agent, James, had said to me, Napoleon would be brilliant for an Adventures in Time. You know, the retreat from Moscow, the Battle of Waterloo, the whiff of grape shot, you know, Josephine.
But it's interesting that two of those are his failures.
Yeah, but they're great moments, aren't they? They're coronation as emperor.
Well, from the British perspective. But I mean, you're not saying Austerlitz or his coronation, which I imagine a French person probably would say.
I did say his coronation. You just weren't listening.
You didn't. You said whiff of grape shot. You didn't mention his coronation.
I said his coronation about 10 seconds afterwards.
Oh, all right. Sorry, I overrode you.
Anyway, the point was, when I broke it all down, as I do, so I was like, right, this, what would be chapter 4? What would be chapter 17? I sort of thought, what, the whole invasion of Russia would have to be one chapter, 3,000 words. And in 3,000 words, you can't really convey, you know, there's no sense of narrative drama because you're skating so...
I think you could. He went there. It was very cold. He came back. It all went wrong.
Yeah, but that's not the point is to create a sense of, and to end the chapters on cliffhangers as well, really important. So Napoleon bit the dust and I'm doing Nelson. The slight difficulty with Nelson is that we know so little about him as a boy.
He fought a polar bear?
That's probably untrue.
Dominic. That's
probably untrue, Tom. But then there's a good period of probably about 10 to 15 years when he doesn't actually do anything very exciting. He's sort of sailing around the Caribbean.
He falls sick.
He does fall sick. Yeah, but there was always falling sick, isn't he? You don't want to play up the sickliness too much because then he'll just look like a weed. I don't think children like a weed.
I don't know. Rising up off your sick bed and scoring the winning goal?
Maybe. Well, a little bit of that, but you can only do so much of that. Anyway, that's what I've been doing. I've been planning out Nelson. I've been reading John Sugden's fantastic book, Roger Knight's book, Andrew Lambert. I think those are the three big texts. I mean, the historiography of the Royal Navy is amazing, isn't it? N.A.M. Rogers' book. What's it called? The Command of the Oceans?
Yeah.
You love all that ever since your conversion a year ago.
Yes. Have we agreed that we are going to go to Chatham?
We've discussed it. There is no... I mean, it's not going to happen anytime soon. That's what I'm going to say. But I've said to you...
But it could happen next year.
Could happen next year. I'm not saying it will happen next year, but it could happen next year. I wouldn't rule it out. And you know that I'm very quick to rule things out when I don't like them. So the fact that I'm... I mean, it could well happen, Tom.
We just had a schedule meeting, didn't we? We were kind of mapping out what we might be doing next year.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, from my point of view, I had to go off because I had things I had to do.
Everybody else was absolutely distraught, as you can imagine.
And so I came back and found that all my plans had been, red lines had been drawn through them.
That's rubbish. That is absolute, that's total, that's just lies.
Well, where was the trip to Chatham, which I would have pushed for very heavily?
But you hadn't put it in the document. If you don't put it in the document...
I didn't know there was a document.
You absolutely did know. That is an absolute lie. I can just imagine Thea's reaction listening to this because you...
Well, I didn't know I was meant to put it in a document.
For the listeners, this is a brilliant insight into how the rest is history works. Thea and I are compiling a document online that everybody puts ideas in. Tom, you've put ideas in that yourself.
No, I gave you a list and I don't know what happened to them, but maybe you put them down.
Yeah, I copied and pasted your ideas into
the
document. Okay,
then I need to go to this document and add to it.
Theo is writing in the margin, I am as disappointed as I am unsurprised.
Okay, well, I'm going to go after the recording this, I'm going to go to this document, this mythical document.
Well, we have some amazing things. I'll tell you what we did. Tom, there was approval. There was the green light to the Punic Wars and Hannibal.
Good.
The green light was given to Luther. And in fact, Theo spoke up for you on that point because Tony made a face, I think it's fair to say.
Honestly.
And Theo was like, no, the Reformation, brilliant. Let's do the loads of episodes on the Reformation. So Theo was batting for you on that. So don't knock Theo.
Luther threw a dog out of a castle window.
Okay.
I mean, who wouldn't like that?
Well, I mean, and what else did I fight for you?
Papal Revolution. Oh, that's good.
The Papal Revolution was mentioned. That's certainly true. And obviously, 100 Years' War. everybody loved the Hundred Years' War. Everybody was very excited about
right.
that. Right.
And so we are going to be doing the interlude as well, aren't we? Half time. We're going to be doing Peasants' Revolt, Chaucer.
Yeah, you're hopefully going to do that this year, aren't you? This autumn.
Deposition of Richard II and Henry IV, parts 1 and 2.
Tom, we're now just having the scheduling meeting again, but in public.
Yes. So, okay. So listen, we must get on to some questions.
Yeah. So do you want to pick a question? We did some last time. We're going to do some more this time. You pick a question.
Well, here's one that isn't entirely a million miles from our scheduling discussion. Panama Joe recently did a bunch of traveling in Turkey and noticed a ton of familiar place names. And it dawned on me that many of the stories and battles from ancient Greece and Rome actually take place in Turkey. This might be obvious to someone who studied the classics, but to someone like me, it came as a surprise. Would you ever consider doing a Classics Gone Wild in Turkey episode about all the Greek and Roman history that actually takes place in Turkey? So we've actually done quite a lot of episodes touching on the classical world in what's now Turkey.
Yeah.
So Trojan War would be the obvious one.
Yeah.
But on the kind of broader question, we often discuss this, do we not, Dominic, that Turkey is a brilliant country if you want the entire sweep of history.
Yeah.
So you've got Çatalhöyük, the oldest kind of stone temple structure, and very, very mysterious, that we talked about in our Atlantis episode, going right the way up to the present day. The history of what is now Turkey has been unfailingly interesting. And we have talked, haven't we, about maybe doing a trip there, doing some episodes on location.
We've tried to indicate as subtly as we can to the Turkish Tourist Board that we would love for them to send us to Turkey.
We are up for being sponsored.
I think because, Tom, we could use that phrase much beloved of travel writers, crossroads of empires.
Crossroads of history.
The meeting place of East and West. But we could talk about the Ottomans. I'd love to do the Ottomans. I'd love to do Ataturk. One of my favorite historical biographies is Andrew Mango's massive book on Ataturk. We could do, imagine doing like Constantinople, sites in Constantinople, Hagia Sophia.
But on the issue of particularly Greek history, I mean, Greeks settled the Aegean coast of what is now Turkey, right the way back to the time of the Trojan War. So the city that becomes Miletus is mentioned by Homer.
Yeah.
And Miletus becomes the great center of early philosophy.
Philosophy, yeah. Croesus and Lydia, Halicarnassus.
Halicarnassus, the birthplace of Herodotus.
Ephesus, we could do so many of these cities.
Yeah, so there's lots to discuss.
Oh, that would be brilliant. I would love that.
So, yeah.
So let's have a question, I think, from Claire H. If it's not from Claire H, I apologize. It's about national mythology. And it comes off the American Revolution series. What are the founding myths of England? Are there British founding myths? There is so much English, Welsh, Scottish history. How can a nation build a narrative around it? So there's obviously a tension here between England and Britain. Tom, there is an English national mythology, isn't there? But there's not really a foundational moment for it, because as much as you might like to think that Athelstan and Æthelflæd are the foundational, I mean, to the general public, they're not very well known.
Well, the foundational myth for the English is Hengist and Horsa, who are two brothers who are supposed to have come over in their ships, invited in by Vortigern, the High King of Britain, and it all goes horribly wrong. And these are the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, who then proceed to conquer what becomes England. And that's a foundational myth that has been very significant, not least for America. So was it Jefferson, I think, wanted Hengist and Horsa to be included on the Great Seal of America? This idea that the Anglo-Saxon settlers embodied particular political traditions that the American founding fathers saw themselves as upholding. I think that that's been a very important myth. And going back earlier, the previous century, in the 17th century, the idea of a Norman yoke being imposed on the freedom-loving Anglo-Saxons, again, was a very kind of motivational story that justified rebellion against the king, and in the long run, his deposition and execution. So the English have definitely had foundational myths. The issue now is, I think, complicated by the fact that the idea of the Angles and the Saxons as a distinctive people is one that raises all kinds of scholarly and scientific hackles.
Mm-hmm.
People are reluctant to talk in those terms now, particularly since the defeat of Nazism. And so the question of who the Angles and Saxons were, whether they were a people with a distinct ethnic identity who came to Britain and displaced the native Britons, or whether it was much more a matter of cultural fashion. I mean, these have been very heated debates for decades and decades now.
We're in Guy Halsall territory here, Tom.
We are.
A very impassioned historian.
And I think that as a result, the saliency of legends like Hengist and Horsa have faded.
I was about to say, so I think while you were talking about Hengist and Horsa and the Norman yoke, I absolutely agree with you, particularly about the Norman yoke, that that was politically very important in the 17th century. But of course, the difference between this and, let's say, Gallipoli in Australia or the Boston Tea Party and all that business in America is that most people on the streets of Nuneaton have never heard of Hengist and Horsa. And probably if you said to them, what's the Norman yoke, they'd say, it's the pub opposite the station. Or they would, you know, they wouldn't never have heard of it.
I think they might have heard of a King Alfred.
They might have heard of King Alfred. Yeah, the name Alfred the Great is the only
I think Alfred the Great, burning cakes.
I think
that's a kind of vague sense of him. Although it's telling that even in 1066 and all that, which was written in what, the late 20s, and it was a joke about the kind of vague stuff that people remember about history. The whole joke about Alfred is that he's endlessly being confused with Arthur.
Yeah.
So even then, there was a sense that people's understanding of the kind of the early years of English history were a bit confused and muddled.
But I think in a way, that's the story, isn't it? So if you take the United States has a starting point. You know, I mean, it has now people argue about the starting point because of what we're talking about last time, the 1619 project. There are a series of moments when someone fires a starting gun. You know, the pilgrims land at Plymouth Rock. Thanksgiving right. happens.
And the 14th of July for the French because of the revolution.
The 14th of July for the French. The whole point in a way of English history, and indeed of British history, is it doesn't have a starting point. You know, people in England love to talk about, I mean, it's not quite right, about the unwritten constitution, layers and layers of history, that it's organic. You know, that's really important to England's and Britain's, that they're both of their sense of themselves, that there isn't a sort of, as it were, an artificial starting point. Don't you think?
Looking at British myth, foundational myths, I think that the sense of Britain is much older than either England or Scotland. And a sense of there being a British identity does seem to have been a part of the kind of the mythic makeup in what becomes England, what becomes Scotland, certainly what becomes Wales in the early medieval period. So the word Alba that is adopted by what becomes the Kingdom of Scotland in the early medieval period, and of course is now ironically the name that Alex Salmond's party, the nationalist leader who left the SNP, and it's kind of slightly more nationalist even than the SNP. But Alba originally meant, it's cognate with Albion, the word for the whole of Britain. And there's a sense that the Scottish kings are identifying themselves with that idea of Britain in exactly the way that Athelstan, the first king of what we might call the United Kingdom of England, is also marketing himself as the Emperor of Britain, and the way in which the people that the English call the Welsh see themselves as the heirs of the whole of Britain. They have these stories that one day they will get back the whole of Britain. So the sense of there being Welsh, English, Scottish identity is relative to the idea of British identity, I think, kind of late developers. And so you still have these stories that are there in the most famously, the account given by Geoffrey of Monmouth of Britain being founded by Brutus, who is a Trojan prince who sails on, comes to England. Sorry, there's a Freudian slip, comes to Britain, but he does come to what will be England because he supposedly lands at Totnes in Devon. And he finds that the land is full of giants and he kills the giants and claims it.
Okay, Tom, we've got to give shorter answers because I'm conscious we've been talking for 15 minutes and we've done one question.
Oh dear, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine, it's fine. Right, here's one for you. It's from Augustus Chung. Just received my signed copy of Pax, shameless plug for Tom. I should never have read this question out. And was admiring the purple slip cover. Was purple really the colour of kings and emperors because of its high cost to produce?
I think more because of its rarity.
Rarity. And what's it based on? What do the people dye? Where does the dye come from?
It's a kind of shell thing.
Okay, that's a very precise answer.
It's the Mumarex, I think it's called.
Okay, well, that's good knowledge.
And it comes from what's now Lebanon.
Yes. Shall I tell you what the Bodleian Library says?
Yes.
Purple has long been associated with royalty because Tyrian purple dye made from the secretions of sea snails was extremely expensive.
Are they Mumarex something? I think that's what they're called.
The spiny dimurex.
Yes, murex. Sorry, I knew it had M and X was in it.
Bolinus brandaris.
And these were indigenous to the coast off the city of Tyre.
Yeah.
So as in Nineveh and Tyre, the famous phrase in the Kipling poem. This was something that the Phoenicians, who we'll be doing an episode on, that was a key part of the produce that they had to flog, kind of a luxury products.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Tom.
Well, of course I am.
All this is true. Probably began as early as 1570 BC, would you believe? And some people think Phoenicia itself may mean land of purple, but you will be shedding light on that when you do an episode about
yes.
the
I think almost certainly that is where it comes from.
Fascinating.
The question of whether the Phoenicians existed is a very current debate.
Josephine Crawley Quinn wrote a biography.
She did.
She is married to somebody I knew at Oxford.
Oh.
There you go.
Small world.
It is a small world. Go on, do you want to choose a question?
Cucumber slice. And this is in the context of the heat waves that we have had this summer in Europe, in America, in China. Are there any noteworthy historical events that are at least somewhat attributable to periods of extreme heat? That's a good question.
That is a good question. That's a really good question.
So the appointment of what's his name as Minister for Drought in 1976 in Britain.
Dennis Howell. The most famous heat wave in British history is in 1976, but it's not really famous for a good reason other than just being a heat wave. But that is the summer when, so Britain was in a terrible mess in the summer of 1976. There was violence at the Notting Hill Carnival. James Callaghan had just become prime minister, and immediately the economy fell into an abyss, not through his fault. And he had to go to the International Monetary Fund to seek a then record $3.9 billion bailout, which was the most the International Monetary Fund could give. And this was seen at the time as the absolute pinnacle of, the nadir, rather, of Britain's international prestige. And there was a sense in which the heat wave, I think it features in one of Ian McEwan's early books, maybe even The Cement Garden, set against this backdrop. There wasn't enough water. People couldn't use, there's droughts, all the reservoirs dry up. So there's a sense in which the country kind of looked cracked and shabby and parched. Because, of course, Britain, with its very moderate climate, is always ill prepared to manage extreme climatic conditions. And in my book, Seasons in the Sun, I actually start in the summer of 1976, because something else that's going on that summer in the heat is the making at Elstree of Star Wars.
Oh.
And the production of Star Wars is famously a bit of a shambles. And the technicians, people were fainting because of the heat while they were making Star Wars. And the guy who plays Chewbacca, Peter Mayhew, it was awful for him in this very furry costume, in this incredibly punishing heat. Because, of course, Britain isn't set up with air conditioning and things like that. So he just kept having to sit down every sort of 2 minutes and dripping with sweat and all of that. So there's that. And there is another episode of heat in the 70s that you and I, we recorded a podcast on just a few weeks ago, Tom, in America. And that's the New York blackout of 1977.
Yes.
And that, again, it was immensely hot. And when the blackout happened, when the power was shut down in New York, all the air conditioning went off and lots of people had to go and sit outside. They couldn't bear being inside in their houses, which became incredibly hot. Anyway, that's my answer. What's your answer about heat? Do you have any good answers?
Well, I would go back to the ancient Near East.
Of course you would.
Where climatologists, we talked about this with Peter Frankopan when he came on to talk about climate change, but there is a sense that many of the kind of the fracture points in ancient Near Eastern history may have been precipitated by cycles of drought, and the cycles of drought presumably are reflective of spikes in heat. I mean, I suppose not necessarily, but I would guess.
Mm.
So the collapse of the Akkadian Empire, the collapse of the Hittite Empire,
yeah.
Intermediate periods in Egypt, they have all been associated with rising temperatures.
Okay, very good.
There you go.
Lovely.
You got another question?
Yeah, I have. It's Teddy Buns. And this is one, it's about the Dutch. I know you like the Dutch. So during the series on Trafalgar, says Teddy, it was discussed how the Royal Navy was sharpened and improved during the setbacks of the Anglo-Dutch Wars, which is absolutely right. When did the Dutch become such good sailors? They were able to beat out the British and Portuguese, or the English and Portuguese. And did their navy hold a similar place in the Dutch imagination as it did in the British, i.e. Protestantism and liberty? So when I was in the Rijksmuseum, I was looking, I mean, lots of people have been teasing you about this online, haven't they, Tom? The
yes.
The fantastic bit of a, I can't remember, I don't know what the technical term is, the bit of a ship that's, that is in the Rijksmuseum that the Dutch stole from the English during the Anglo-Dutch Wars. What's the technical term for it? You with your newfound knowledge of naval? It's the kind of...
It's the back.
The back of the ship.
Is it the poop? I think maybe it's the poop. I don't know.
I will look it up while you discourse about the Dutch. Do you think the Dutch Navy became a big...
Yes, absolutely. Well, so again, we talked about this in our episode on Amsterdam. that so many of the ports on what becomes the Netherlands look out to the North Sea, and their source of income derives from fishing. So that provides a kind of an inheritance of ability to handle ships that in the early years of the Dutch revolts becomes incredibly significant. So you have these figures, the sea beggars, who play a key role in the Dutch revolt in sustaining the ability of the Dutch in their rebellion against the Spanish in the 16th century. And that is a kind of part, you know, that's, we've been talking about foundational myths, the role played by these sea beggars, these hardy mariners in securing Dutch freedom, becomes a vital part of the mythology of the emergent Dutch Republic. And so you can see that patriotic sense that to go to sea and fight your enemies is everything that has given you your liberty, that combined with the inheritance of nautical ability would make the Dutch a very, very proficient naval power. And so it proves in the 17th century.
Plus, of course, as you said in the Trafalgar episodes, the huge importance of the financial instruments that will allow you to, because, yeah, I mean, ships are expensive, equipping them, the colossal quantities, I mean, dare I say, Tom, the colossal quantities of rope and of nails and all these things.
Rope.
I mean, if you don't have the financial underpinnings, the state machinery, and the Dutch did.
And it's not a coincidence that the two preeminent capitalist powers in the 17th century, namely the Dutch Republic and England, also emerge as the two preeminent naval powers.
I thought I'd land to do a bit of a hospital pass there. I didn't know about the sea beggars. I thought that was tremendously interesting. But while you were talking,
yeah,
I've looked it up. It's the stern transom.
Stern transom.
Of the Royal Charles. So it was captured by Dutch forces in 1667 at its home port of Chatham near London and towed over the North Sea to the Netherlands, the whole vessel, the Royal Charles, where it was scrapped. But this decoration, because it's called a transom or a counter, it's got the arms of Charles II. This was preserved to commemorate, says the Rijksmuseum, this extraordinary Dutch triumph and England's defeat. So it's a shame that they haven't decolonized themselves and returned.
I know, very shameful, isn't it?
The artifact. But there it is. It is a magnificent thing, isn't it, actually, Tom? So when I went to the Rijksmuseum, I didn't feel sorry to see this. I felt proud of British wood carving workmanship.
Did you?
I did.
Did you? You didn't feel that it was a vital part of our national culture that should be restored?
I felt that too. But I'm not generally in favour of museums stripping out their collections, so I'll allow the Dutch to keep it.
But of course, when we go to Chatham, Dominic, we can do an episode on this, on the Battle of the Medway and the Dutch raid.
So you're on Chatham again. We've only just been talking about this, Tom. We're back onto the scheduling meeting.
Well, you know me.
Yeah.
When I get my teeth into a subject, I like to worry it to death.
Dogged is, I think, what your fans would say, and your critics might say something different.
Annoying.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying that. Okay, Ian B., here is one for you. Ian B., long-time friend of the show. He says, when the Roman emperors became Christian, was there ever a questioning of whether the empire should still exist and that it was in conflict with Christianity and should therefore be dissolved? I can guess what your answer is, but give it anyway.
No.
And that's because the empire was seen as the vehicle through which Christianity would be exported, right?
Yes.
Christian universalism and Roman universalism
were one and the same.
One and the same.
And this is an assumption that survives the collapse of the Roman Empire. So when Gregory the Great, the great pope in the 6th century, sends missionaries to convert the pagan Anglo-Saxons, the reason he is doing that is because the Anglo-Saxons are inhabiting a former British province. And so therefore he feels that he, as a figure in Rome, Bishop of Rome, a Roman nobleman, that he has the absolute right to do that and responsibility to do that. That having said that, there is a very, very significant figure who questions this association of the Roman Empire with God's purpose in spreading Christianity. And that's Augustine. His greatest and most celebrated text, The City of God, is counterpointed to the City of Man, which is basically Rome.
Yeah.
And Augustine's point is that the world is fallen and that empires, like human beings, are like leaves born upon the great river of time, and that only the religio, the bond that joins the fallen earth to the radiance of heaven, can redeem them.
Okay. Tom, a quick question for you, though, a follow-up on that. Is there not a sense, though, the funny thing is that Rome becomes Christianized, or the Roman Empire becomes officially Christian, at a point at which it has also become much more militarized?
Yes.
You know, generals running the empire. Is there ever a conflict between those two things?
So by the 10th century, there is a famous incident where the emperor Nikephoros,
yeah,
which means you know, the carrier of victory. He is a seasoned fighter against the Saracens, as he would call them. And he is familiar with Islamic ideology, which says that those who are fighting for Islam in battle will go to heaven. They will be included among the ranks of martyrs. And Nikephoros goes to the patriarch in Constantinople and says, you know, what about it? Could we have a bit of this? Mm-hmm. And the patriarch says no. And not only does he refuse it, but he says that any soldier fighting who kills, even in defense of the Roman Empire, will have to do penance for it. As of course, you know, lots of people do. William the Conqueror builds Battle Abbey as an act, a gesture of penance. So there is a kind of enduring ambivalence about that. That is what makes the Crusades so, I mean, it's why the Byzantines see the Crusades as so shocking.
Okay. Ian B has another question. He has a question for me, actually. Which period is more analogous to the current state of cultural and political polarization in the West? The 60s, 30s, the 1890s, and so on and so forth. Some other period when the pendulum has swung towards polarization. My answer to that is all of them have lots of polarization in, because it seems to be a strange conceit of our times that there is something unusual or unhealthy about a degree of polarization. It's rather like, I think it's very similar to people who get very hot under the collar about this, the idea of a culture war. So they say, oh, the Tories confected culture war and all this kind of thing. And I think this is absolute gibberish and tosh. I think all these periods that you mentioned, Ian, the 60s, the 30s, whenever, the 1890s, I mean, goodness, the 1890s, so polarized in so many different ways. They were all periods of tremendous anxiety, argument, people who were saying their opponents were illegitimate, all of these kinds of things. The thing is that those things are always there, I would say, but they feel especially salient and unsettling at times of great economic turmoil, I think. Say, for example, in the 60s, there are lots of people in the 60s, let's say in Britain, swinging London in full swing, people wearing miniskirts, England winning the World Cup, the Beatles, hurrah, hurrah. And yet there are thousands, arguably millions of households in Britain where people are saying, the country's gone to the dogs, Harold Wilson is a traitor, you know, all this. But it doesn't feel as charged and impassioned because actually the economy is fine and, you know, people don't notice, as it were. But I think there are points when the cultural arguments, which are always there and actually which are perfectly natural and normal, so arguments about identity, arguments about your history, all those things, when they feel especially, they carry an electric charge. But I don't think there's any points when they're not there. Tom, what do you think?
I don't think it's the 1930s. So I don't think that we're heading towards fascism.
No.
Is one agreed. Point. But I think one interesting parallel that we have discussed before is perhaps with the 1820s and 1830s, a sense that we are emerging from a period of libertinism into an age of moral seriousness.
Yeah, what a depressing thought.
And I think if you contrast the, say, the 90s with now, we are a much more morally sober culture.
Yeah. See, what I hate about that, Tom, is I liked being the most censorious person in the room. So I liked it when it was the late 90s, 2000s, Tony Blair, people like you, off your heads on coke.
I wasn't off my head on coke.
Doing whatever you're doing.
That's an absolute libelous comment.
Thinking nothing matters, all of that. And I could be Mr. Grumpy, trying to spoil other people's fun, you know, the soul of Puritanism. And then suddenly...
But now you're censorious about people's censoriousness, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I hate censorious people.
I know you do. John Lennon, Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But now I find myself that, the youth... with their censorious ways and their moralism. Actually, it's moral seriousness that I object to. That's what I really dislike.
You're saying all the young listeners, you hate them.
I don't, because I think by definition, we would attract to the bonus podcast. we would attract, surely not, you know. I mean, the people who are likely to cancel me are unlikely to be subscribing to our podcast.
Oh, they're getting material on you.
Or are they gaining material? That is the question, isn't it, Tom? That hangs over whenever I go to an Athelstan gathering. And by the way, for those of you who are not Athelstans, I can't recommend them enough.
Great fun.
But when I go to an Athelstan gathering, always at the back of my mind is the possibility that some of those people may be woke informers preparing dossiers on our behavior, waiting for us to say that we like live and let die or whatever it might be. And these things will be brought up at our trials after the revolution.
The Isle of Man beckons.
It does indeed.
And indeed, we are followed, aren't we, by an account that is very upset that we never mentioned the Isle of Man.
That's so true.
On Twitter.
That's so true. But it's got your face on it, this account.
Yes, it has. So if whoever runs that account is listening, we have just mentioned the Isle of Man.
Yeah.
So we hope that you are happy about that. And on that note, we will bid you adieu.
Goodbye.